Welcome to Equal Time on WLUR 91.5 FM, Lexington. I'm Brian Murchison, your host. Each week, we'll discuss issues that are important to the university, the community, or the country as a whole. Our goal is simple: smart conversation from different perspectives. Welcome to the show. Glad you found us. We're usually on Tuesdays at 7, but this week it's a Thursday show. And next week, just to keep it interesting, we'll be on Wednesday. Everybody got that? Why Wednesday next week? Well, it'll be the night after the election, and there may be some things to talk about. In fact, we'll have an all-star lineup to talk about the 2004 vote, what got decided, what didn't get decided, the whole 100 or 99 yards. So join us then next Wednesday at 7 for that show. You know, it's been such a pleasure for me to do this show while I've been on sabbatical from the law school. Come over to WLUR once a week and to interview some of the most interesting people in the area. Tonight is no exception. In a little while, I'll be talking with Leslie Giles, Executive Director of the Historic Lexington Foundation, one of those organizations that make Lexington what it is. I'll be asking Leslie all about what she does for HLF and about what HLF has been doing lately for the town. But first, with me in the studio right now is Burr Datz, Director of the Leadership Development Program at Washington and Lee. I would wager that most of you listening out there know this man or know of him, but if you don't, you should. You'd be missing something of the WNL experience if your path somehow did not cross his path. He's a remarkable communicator, counselor, teacher, musician, leader, servant, golfer, husband, father. He gave the 2004 baccalaureate address at WNL last spring. Were you there? It was half spoken, half sung, accompanied by his own guitar, and it was a speech none of us will soon forget. Burr is a 1975 grad of WNL. He was a school teacher for a while. He was a campus minister for the Diocese of Richmond. He was assistant golf coach at WNL for some years. Besides heading up the Leadership Development Program, he's faculty advisor to one of the fraternities. He's the secretary for ODK at Washington and Lee. He's a care resource. He's chaplain. I could go on. He's one of the people who make this place what it is. Burr, welcome to the show. Sorry to run on, but I had to say something.
Oh, my time's almost up.
Your time is up. That's good. Next guest.
Thanks.
What is the Leadership Development Program?
That's a great question. It depends on how people like to define leadership. And there are a lot of different models, a lot of different definitions of leadership, and I prefer to consider it to think of it as the creation of a culture of shared leadership, such that it stresses all the things that the university mission statement stresses: personal honor, integrity, harmonious relationships with others, and a responsibility to serve others through the productive use of their time and talent. Now, that means that leadership is both something that an individual can acquire as well as groups, because if it's a shared process, then the group dynamic can take over and leadership becomes a shared responsibility rather than a positional or a hierarchical issue.
Yeah, but can an individual really acquire that talent for leading?
I believe so. I think that the great old theory, the oldest theory of leadership, is kind of the great man theory. That one person possesses leadership skills.
You're born with it or something.
Exactly. That it's this innate charisma. And former President Clinton, I think, embodied that. So did Ronald Reagan. They were great communicators. When they walked into a room, they just attracted a lot of attention. And that's one way of leading, in getting people to follow you. Mm-hmm. I think there's another way of looking at leadership, which is the ability to influence others. And regardless of your abilities, you can learn certain – you can be taught, you can be trained to pick up what I consider certain tangible skills of leadership. So strategic planning, goal setting, mm-hmm. time management, mm-hmm. these are teachable skills that any individual can learn. Now, does that mean that the quiet – wallflower kind of person who doesn't have that outgoing personality? Are they going to be as effective a leader as Presidents Reagan or Clinton? Probably not. But they still can exercise that influence over others, maybe one-on-one, one-on-two, in such a way that a group can change and move.
So you came in when this program was created.
Correct.
And what you've been doing is to, among other things, hold some seminars on these topics.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
The ingredients of leadership or the how-to?
Yeah, I think they're tangible and intangible skills. The tangible ones, some of which I've mentioned. The intangible skills of leadership are more about character. And the heart of a leader. So integrity would be one of those intangible skills. I think integrity is a lot like the weather. We love it when it's good, and when it's bad, we don't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
And so what I want to do is just have a conversation about integrity or virtues. Is it important for leaders to embody virtues? And if so, what are those virtues that leaders should embody?
Well, what are some of those?
Well, I think there are theological virtues like faith, hope, and charity or love. And then there are what are known, at least in a classical sense, the cardinal virtues of temperance, fortitude, wisdom, and compassion.
And are these the virtues of a leader or virtues of any good person?
Well, is any good person a leader? I would hope that a good person is going to attract others mm-hmm. to, you know, what makes you good or what makes me good. Is somebody going to follow us around to see how we act? Because the way we act is much more important than the words we say.
I see. So the development of the virtues can be a way to influence issues by attracting people to you. On that basis. Is that the idea?
Yes, but it's not that I'm conscious of attracting somebody to me. It's more that I'm a mirror that's reflecting these values out. I'm not trying to attract people to me as a light would attract others to share in that light. It's more like being a mirror so that we can reflect those, or like being a pane of glass. You know, if you come into a beautifully designed room that an engineer and architect have put together, there's this beautiful view. You're attracted to the view. You're not attracted to the glass.
That's right.
So I think the most effective leaders are the ones that are going to be transparent. So the light, in a sense, shines through us, or the view of a goal is something that we communicate often, but it's not about me as a leader. It's about we or us as a community and how we achieve that goal.
And you include some other sort of paradoxes. The leader is servant. Is that one of the ideas that you have talked about?
Yes, it is. Actually, it's not original. Robert Greenleaf came up with this theory back in the 70s. Robert Greenleaf was an executive for AT&T for many, many years, and he read Journey to the East by Hermann Hesse.
Oh.
And it's an interesting story. It tells about six different or eight different people that go on a journey to meet this Zen master up in the mountains. And there's a Sherpa, a guide, who carries a lot of their stuff and cooks for them and gets them through these mountain passes. His name was Leo. And about 2 days prior to their arrival at the temple, Leo disappeared. And the six or eight people, I can't remember the exact details, but what kept them together was Leo. He was the glue. And their relationships frayed. A lot of important things didn't get done. They get to the temple. They're all flustered and anxious and upset, and they meet with the great master, who happens to be Leo. And so Greenleaf reflected on this and said, how can we as leaders act as servants?
And how can we? Did he come up with any formula for that?
Yes, he's got 10 different characteristics of a servant leader, and I can't remember all 10 of them. But the ability to listen is one. In Greenleaf's theory, and what I'm discovering more and more as I put on Rope's challenge experience, is that when groups really pay attention to what everybody else is saying, they come up with a better plan. When they're empathetic, when they're understanding about what all of them are going through. The ability to empower others to act. So I may be the boss, but it's not about me. It's about, can you do your job? Mm-hmm. Well, if I trust in you, then yeah, I'm gonna want you to do your job.
You mentioned the ropes. You must be referring to that array of ropes and platforms up by the tennis center, and that's part of the leadership program.
Yes, it is.
Explain how that all fits in.
Essentially, a group or an individual representing a group will say, we want to do a ropes course experience, that they've had some experience in the past.
On the premise that this will help them
develop teamwork or communication. Every group has a different goal. And so you want a group. Let's just suppose that you want a group to come through. And I'll ask, well, what are your goals? What do you want everybody to leave with? So today, for example, Professor Perkel, who is a teacher for Management 375, it's a capstone management class, said, I want them to be able to communicate a little better. I want them to work together as a team rather than just a couple of individuals who have tended to dominate projects. And that's typically what happens. More extroverted people tend to take charge, and more introverted folks kind of allow that, unless it's a train wreck about to happen. That's a dynamic.
Is that usually a trust thing, that the extrovert doesn't trust the others to do as well or as fast or as...
I'm an extrovert, and honest, I don't even think about it.
Yeah.
It's just, this is who I am. Let's do this. Let's try that. And until I learned that I, as an extrovert, really need to ask introverts, what am I missing?
Yeah.
I'm missing something.
So Professor Perkel wanted you to work with that class?
Oh, exactly.
So what happened then?
Well, I had to come up with a curriculum, develop a curriculum of low events for 2 hours to help them learn to communicate better, help them learn to strategize, set goals, and work together to achieve those. So basically they held hands in a circle, and I took a hula hoop, and they were holding a hula hoop in their hands, okay? And the hula hoop was looped around two people's hands. And I asked them to tell me how long it would take them as a group to move the hula hoop around that circle so that they're stepping through it and moving it over their heads without letting go of their hands.
Yeah.
And they came up with a goal of about 7.5 minutes because they'd never tried it before. They achieved that in 2 minutes and 24 seconds. So we talked about setting goals, why groups tend to set higher goals than really difficult goals. What worked? What are the techniques? What strategized? There was a question that I didn't hear asked, which I think is a crucial question that any group or organization should ask before they do anything, and that's, has anybody done this before? And one of the students had. And one of the students had done this before, so she could realize that, you know, a 7-minute goal was just way out there.
Yeah.
It just wasn't challenging enough. So they set another goal of a minute, and they didn't attain that. So we, again, looked at what are the things that led to the success in the first exercise, because they beat their goal. What prevented that success in the second? So they moved people in different areas. They experimented with some techniques. Basically, it's an APPLE method, APPLE. That when I pose a challenge or an initiative to overcome, every group has an opportunity to assess it, to make a plan, to make last-minute preparations, to lead it, and then to evaluate it.
Hmm.
And sometimes the evaluation takes place in the midst of the initiative itself. But the sensitivity to that process for a group, say, of 14 today, was just wonderful.
Well, suppose you have some resistors in there. Are there usually some who don't want to deal with this regimen?
Oh, yeah. They're way too cool for school. Happens all the time. And so they're challenged by choice. You can participate. If you choose to participate, great. You can you choose to participate mind, body, heart, and soul. And if you're afraid of heights, for example, then you don't have to participate in this. But my experience is that there's a positive peer pressure that a group can see. It's part of this. You're familiar with Joe Harry's window? There are four panes to a window. There's the me that I know about that I'm willing to share with you. There's the me that I know about myself that I'm unwilling to share with you. There's the me that I'm not aware of, but you see. And then there's this fourth pane, which is neither you nor I know all about me. Right. So in a crisis or a pressure situation, in that third pane, you may see that I can achieve something that I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of climbing a ladder. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know I can do it. Are you going to encourage me to do that? Mm-hmm. And I, my experience is that we do.
You know, in your baccalaureate address, you quoted Cardinal Newman, to live is to change, and to be perfect is to have changed often. That's harder than it sounds. When you really think about what that means, it's quite a challenge. What attracted you to that statement? And what were you trying to say to the class as it was graduating last spring with that?
Because their lives had changed so much. Yeah. And I think that at a place like Washington and Lee, we very much get caught up in tradition. And it's easy to look back with the rose-colored nostalgic glasses and wish that everything was as it was when we arrived as freshmen, maybe. And
they've been through quite a lot.
They had. And the vibrancy of any community, any organization, that has to ebb and flow. It has to grow. It has to change in order to remain dynamic. Yeah. And that they've lived through this for 4 years. They're going to face change after change after change in their coming decades. And here's a positive way to look at that.
But does a leader know somehow instinctively when it's time to change versus when it's time to not change, hold on to the tradition, stand still? Is that part of the decision-making dynamic that you help students think about?
I help them think about it, yes. If it were magic in a bottle, go, here's the formula for to know when to change, when not to change, I'd be a millionaire.
Yeah.
A billionaire. And it isn't that easy. It's in many cases, it's kind of discerning the signs of the times, judging who the people are. Can they make that change? What's their maturity in terms of an ability to try something new? There's a great, great book out called The Deep Blue Sea. It's written by Wilfred Drath, who works with he's a fellow at the Center for Creative Leadership. And it looked at a piano company. This company was started by these two guys 50 years ago when they were in their 20s. And they decided that they were going to make pianos for new piano students, affordable, quality instruments. And they did this for 50 years. And one fella was getting ready to sell it, and his granddaughter, maybe it was a daughter, had gotten her MBA or something, and he was getting give the reins to the company over to her. And she's looking at this dying market in quality wooden pianos and saying, we need to go with digitized keyboard equipment. Meanwhile, of the people that had worked at that corporation, for a man who'd been the leader of it for 50 years, they didn't understand why they had to change.
Right.
They felt that that was disloyal to the vision. And so here comes the granddaughter, who's the new leader, and she's got to get them to buy in to a new vision, a new change in keeping this company viable.
Right.
And it's a masterful book.
Did she succeed?
Yes, and it took a lot of listening to the employees and the managers to convince them that this was a change that would benefit not only them as employees, but all those hundreds of thousands of kids who wanted to learn how to play piano.
You know, your speech last spring mentioned Dean Laybourne. Most of us know him as the name on a building here. you heard him speak. He was around when you were a student, right? What was he like? Was he a leader?
Oh, without question.
What were his qualities?
I remember like it was yesterday. My first time walking into Lee Chapel, and he came walking up between us or along the side, white hair, meticulously groomed, pressed gray suit. And I was sitting over on the left side of Lee Chapel. It was in the afternoon, and he was talking about arete and expectations.
Arete?
It means excellence and virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that we had expectations as freshmen in a new environment, and that the expectations of the people that had been here for a long time were that we were going to be successful, that we were going to embody honor, that we were going to embody arete. And it was powerful.
Yeah. So who else are your heroes when you think of, when you talk about leadership to students, are there examples that you give?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But I prefer to, I like giving the test first.
And see what they say.
Exactly.
Have undergraduates thought about some of these questions?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. But my experience is that they're so caught up with keeping their balls in the air. They're given a number of different things to balance. They've got academics. They've got their own relationships as classmates and friends and teammates. They've got their relationships with mom and dad and friends back home. They've got athletic commitments. They've got club commitments, groups, organizations. I mean, our students are very, very busy.
And I think I see the posters around campus for your seminars that I think are at lunch sometimes, mm-hmm. or sometimes in the evening. And those moments must be sort of sanctuaries away from all of that, where the students can actually think about some of these issues in their own lives. Is that what you're striving for?
Exactly. Just to try and have a conversation like we're having mm-hmm. a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, for example, the topic was integrity. So leadership with integrity. Is integrity an essential part of leadership? Jim Kuznets and Barry Posner wrote a book called The Leadership Challenge about 10 years ago. And what they did was interview Fortune 500 company executives, upper-level management, mid-level management, vice presidents, etc. 11,000 people over 10 years. They wanted to find out what made great leaders. Why are Fortune 500 companies in that elite? And what they discovered was that of all the qualities that followers want in their leaders, honesty and integrity was mentioned by 83%.
Amazing.
So what is it? Well, Stephen Carter, who's a professor at Yale, wrote a really interesting book on integrity, and he says it has a three-part definition or three steps to it. The first is to discern what's right from wrong. The second is to act on it, even at personal cost. And then the third is to articulate why you've done what you've done.
Mm-hmm. That second one, even at personal cost, pretty tough.
Oh, absolutely. And our culture just gives us a great example that we spoke about briefly on the phone. Ashley Simpson last Saturday night.
Okay, what about Ashley Simpson?
Did she act with integrity? That's the question.
So when she was faking it or afterwards?
Okay, well, here's the issue. She's a 19-year-old pop star. She's got a number one hit. What are the pressures that a 19-year-old debuting on probably the greatest watched comedy show in the history of TV? What are those pressures? What is right from wrong? In Lucky Magazine, she gives a statement that personally, and this is a quote, personally, I'd never lip sync. But apparently she had dinner on Saturday and developed acid reflux disease. So her vocal cords were swollen, and her doctor, her vocal doctor, this is all through news reports, so I may be stretching a little, wants to know, should I sing? And her father happens to be her manager, and he says, well, no, just use a backup track. So she's got to discern what's right and what's wrong. Is it wrong to lip sync? Is it wrong to risk damaging her vocal cords? So she's got to deal with that all in a question, 4 hours maybe.
And she chooses to run the tape.
Well, she ran the tape, so that's what she did. How she dealt with it, afterwards was a lot of blame. Basically, she blamed her band. And then, like all musicians, you blame the drummer, not just the band. You have to blame the
drummers. Yeah, the drummers always, usually don't fare
always
well.
Always the drummers. Then on Katie Couric's Today Show, she said that, why are people picking on me? I didn't get married in Las Vegas. I didn't show a boob. I'm not anorexic.
Yeah.
So she's in this third step. She's not focusing at all on her own behavior. She's trying to distract us from this question. And her father actually said, and I quote, I don't think this will affect her credibility with kids. They won't care. And I think if that's true, that's a really sad thing in our culture, because then we're stuck with a kind of a Wizard of Oz, where there's a lot of stuff going on behind the curtains. And what's behind the curtains is, if that's the leadership that we look to, it's pretty sad. Mm-hmm. So I want to say, no, this is how we want to look at something. If I've got a bad, I'm a musician, I'm an entertainer, so if I got a bad throat, I'm going to tell people, you know, my throat stinks tonight, bear with me.
Right.
And I'll sound like a dog. And I think that people will accept that a lot better than me trying to fake some lip sync thing. But again, it comes down to honesty.
Yeah. The for 2 days running, CNN, the talking heads were on the morning show, were just laughing at her. And I think sometimes ridicule is sort of the worst thing she could hope to get. So integrity is what 80% of those employees were looking for in a leader.
Yeah. They want to know, what does a leader value? What's right from wrong? They want to know that the leader's going to act on that.
Yeah. What are we seeing in the campaign now in terms of leadership models, the presidential campaign?
Great question. At the risk of oversimplification, we've got a president who is very decisive, very hierarchical in his understanding of leadership, that he is the president and he makes those decisions. It is a model that is not very collaborative, at least on a international scale. And that decisiveness, at least from Democratic voices, is being judged as being stubborn and obstinate and single-minded. And yet that's a quality that appeals to at least half of our population, if I'm judging by the polls. On the other hand, we have a presidential candidate who is much more process-oriented, appears to be much more collaborative. In fact, that process orientation would say, okay, well, this is what I think we ought to do, and then as time may show that that's not what we do, he could change his mind. Well, that becomes flip-flopping, and so there are some people that feel that that is very appealing.
And some people vote for one model or the other at different historical moments, I guess.
Exactly. And what I think it's going to come down to, it comes down to Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And you give me food, you give me clothing, you give me shelter. That's my basic need. Right above that is keep me safe. Mm-hmm. So if our security is such that we're willing to shut the doors and lock everything and be protected in our own little bunkers, then that's certainly one decision. And the another would be, well, let's keep working out a dialogue.
Mm-hmm. We've got only a few minutes, Burr, but I wanted to ask you about the NCAA grant that I think you helped get for the school. What is that all about? What's going on with that part of the leadership program?
It's a grant. I'm working with Dr. Joel Fish from the Center for Sports Psychology in Philadelphia, and he works with the Flyers, Phillies, and 76ers. And what we're trying to do is get the captains, the coaches, and the student-athlete mentors to recognize what leadership is. And it's not necessarily just the great and gifted athlete who other people are going to follow. It's working with them to recognize what these abilities and skills are and develop them not only for the individual but for the team, that this is leadership of a team nature. So we're looking at mental toughness as one of those qualities. So in sports competition, for example, there are going to be from 3 to 5 crux moments when momentum can swing and things are going to change.
During the contest, during
Absolutely.
The game.
Right. And so if I can bring, as an athlete, 3 to 5% more mental focus, that increases my ability to succeed by 25%.
Wow, you definitely see that on the faces of tennis players. I mean, Sampras and Graf were supposedly mentally the fittest. So you're working on that, on how to capitalize on those moments, or how to rise to the occasion on those moments.
Exactly, and for our students to also recognize that sports is a metaphor for life, and that we're here in Division III to get a great education and to learn how to compete and to cooperate.
So it's not just the search for this individual leader, but the group as leader.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for coming in tonight. I wish we had more time, and maybe I can invite you to come back next semester when we can talk more about the leadership program and the 100 other things that you do around campus. One last question. What about the law students? Are you trying to pull them into some of your seminars?
And you know, they're so busy. They make busy compared to the undergraduates look like an art form.
We used to, you know, graduate law students who wanted to go back to their home communities and practice law and also be community leaders. Now, maybe that's some fuzzy 50s vision that I need to get rid of, but it would be nice if some more people had that opportunity.
I'm going to continue to try and offer it to them. And, you know, you can only coach the players that show up.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, and we will talk to you again in the future. Bird Datz, Director of the Leadership Development Program at Washington & Lee, thanks for coming in. We will take a 1 or 2 minute break and then come back with Leslie Childs of the historic Lexington Foundation.
Would it be crazy if you just stopped everything? Packed your bags and left for a week, a month, a year. What if you left for 2 years? Would people think you'd lost your mind? What if you were going far away to help in a village on the edge of the Gobi Desert? A village crowded with Buddhist temples, not skyscrapers. A place where there isn't a word for recluse, but 1,000 words for community. Would it be crazy to go 5,000 miles from home? To spend time with people the rest of the world only reads about. To build libraries and fill them with stories. Prepare a meal with food you helped grow. To teach children and learn a thing or two about yourself. Would that be crazy? Peace Corps. Life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
We are back on Equal Time, WLUR 91.5 FM in Lexington. I'm Brian Murchison, and my next guest is Leslie Giles. She's the executive director of the Historic Lexington Foundation. Leslie has been in Lexington for about 7 years. She's originally from Texas. She has an undergraduate degree from University of Texas at Austin, a master's in architectural history from UVA. She's worked for New York State and the Commonwealth of Virginia in historic preservation offices and has been executive director of the Historic Lexington Foundation since 2002. Mm-hmm. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about Historic Lexington Foundation. What is it? What are its goals? How long has it been around?
Well, the group was formed back in 1966, so we're coming up in just a couple of years on our 40th anniversary. We were one of the earliest historic preservation organizations founded in the Commonwealth.
That's saying something, because I would bet there
Well, the earliest, of course, was the Association for the Preservation of Virginia Antiquities, which was the earliest in the entire country. Mm-hmm. And they're still a statewide organization operating out of Richmond, principally. But in terms of local organizations doing historic preservation advocacy and working essentially at the grassroots level to do the work of historic preservation and cultural preservation, there have always, you know, been historical societies like the Rockwich Historical Society, organizations that operate museums, But for an organization to actually own historic properties just for the sake of preserving them, as opposed to making them into museums, that was sort of a relatively new concept back in the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. And HLF was established by a small group of folks in the community, both locals and people who had come to the community with WNL or with VMI in some association, and who saw and recognized the value of the historic buildings that we had here. And we were fortunate back in the late 1960s to be able to work with those folks in such a way that we were able to buy threatened buildings one or two at a time in the downtown, restore their exteriors, and then resell them to sympathetic property owners who continued the hard work of restoring their interiors and turning them into viable operating businesses in the downtown.
Tremendous public service. Was the Stonewall Jackson House one of those properties?
We did acquire it in the 1970s. That was after it was a hospital. It was either purchased or gifted, I'm not sure, mm-hmm. to the Lee Jackson Memorial Foundation. And when they realized that they had bigger fish to fry in other communities like Alexandria and sort of earlier Confederate history sites that they owned, they thought it was a better idea to try to establish a local group or to work with a local group who would take on the property. Mm-hmm. And Historic Lexington Foundation did acquire it, along with two other buildings, the Davidson Tucker House, which is where the Stonewall Jackson Foundation has their offices now, and something known as the Boiler House, located directly behind the Davidson Tucker House. Those were all acquired from the Lee Jackson or from the Lee Foundation. And Historic Lexington put together a very large fundraising campaign for that era, for the early 1970s, and put over $450,000 into the development of the Stonewall Jackson House as a museum.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the buildings that all of us seeking pizza at various times of the week have noticed is the house next to Salerno's on, I guess, Jefferson Street. A lot of activity in the last 6 months. That old house being kind of lifted and it looks like work on the foundation done, and then the house being put back together again. Is this one of the properties that your group has been involved with?
Yes, the Roberson Phelan House, which is at 111 South Jefferson Street.
Right next to the pizza place.
Right next to the pizza place and across the street from the brand-new parking lot.
Right.
Where the old fire department used to be. We acquired that in late January of last year. From the estate of the family of Jack Roberson, who was the last occupant of that house.
Jack was quite a well-known figure in town, wasn't he?
Yes. He was, I think, widely regarded as somewhat of an eccentric, and the auction of his estate was very widely attended because of the caliber of the antiques that were reputed to be in the house and part of his possession that most people never got a chance to see because he was somewhat of a recluse but he was also a very widely known and regarded person in the realm of the decorative arts and American antiques.
I personally did not know him, but I remember meeting him once and talking to him at some length, and it was fascinating. So, were there a lot of antiques in there that were then sold at the
auction? I think there were some very fine early American pieces that I think his specialty was early American and mm-hmm. Late colonial period.
House itself, what was it made out of?
Well, the house itself is really quite unusual for downtown Lexington today. Once upon a time, before a great fire at the end of the 18th century, Lexington was largely built out of wood. After that fire, the buildings that had survived and the buildings that were then built tended to be out of brick or stone just for the sake of reducing fire losses. The Roberson Phelan House is actually a timber frame structure. Timber framing was not that common in this part of the state for early structures. The Roberson House was built on the property. The first part was built in the 1820s. Then it was added to in the 1840s. And during that time period in this part of Virginia, architecture that was of wooden construction tended to be either of log or of in the later part of that time range of stick built, typical wooden construction. Timber framing was something where you sort of tended to overbuild, but it led to a much longer lasting structure that could also be dismantled and moved to a new location. And there is some possibility that the Roberson House or components of it resided elsewhere in their initial lives and then were moved to the Roberson property, to the Jefferson Street location, and then sort of connected together. We don't know all of the earliest history of the property because tax records and written history is pretty sketchy for the early part of the 19th century when you come to a specific building that wasn't owned by a Lee or a Jackson.
But that was Jack Roberson's family.
His family his family acquired it in the 1920s, actually.
Did he grow up there?
He grew up most of his – he was probably already 8 or 9 years old when his family bought the property. He did have a younger sister who was born in Lexington and was raised in that house her entire life. But
so how did HLF get involved?
We became involved when it became clear to us that the property after Jack's death would have to be sold out of the estate in order for the family, which no longer lives in the area, to be able to get out of it. And there were rumors flying around town that it would be a good parking lot, or that it was because of the advanced state of deterioration that the building had suffered over time, that it would have to be torn down because of its condition.
Salvaged.
Right. There was some sense that it couldn't be salvaged. But
had anyone been in it? I'm sure had.
Some few had been in it, and it probably was not should not have been occupied in the state in which it was being occupied, because there were a lot of health concerns and things that the average family wouldn't, put their child in the kind of situation where this house had gotten to. But once all of the antiques and other materials were removed from the property, and we had a chance to go in and look around and see what was actually still there, it became very clear to us that not only was this an old house, but it was an old house that was somewhat fragile because of its condition, but it was also extremely intact to the early 19th century period, which for Lexington is very odd. Most historic buildings in this community are certainly very well cherished by their owners and their occupants and very well taken care of, and sometimes being very well taken care of means having a lot of your original materials stripped out and replaced with modern materials that match the old. And so there's a lot of loss of historic fabric
when they do
in a lot of older buildings. And this particular building you know, was essentially intact to the 1930s period at the very latest. That had probably been the time when most of the latest modifications to the original structure had taken place.
So you all thought this needs to be preserved.
We really believe that you know, that it had wonderful bones still and had wonderful character, retains an enormous amount of original woodwork, has a wonderful interior staircase, which is a little bit odd in how it's laid out, which is, it's very unusual for the area. It has remarkable woodwork that still survives. Because of the fact that it was timber framed, it was a structure that lent itself to preservation more so than a typical wood frame structure would have.
I mean, how so?
Well, a timber frame structure has fewer structural supports, and they tend to be bigger, fewer and bigger, and focused on the corners and on the main pressure points, mm-hmm. Stress points of the structure. It turned out to be very fortunate that not only did this house have a timber frame structure, but it also had between every vertical structural member on the first floor, it also had something called brick nogging, which is sort of an early and primitive, not primitive, but not so effective form of insulation, mm-hmm. where you had essentially bricks filling up the wall cavities in between the structural members. And had it not been for those sort of first floor supplemental brick walls, the house probably would have collapsed 30 years ago because the foundation was just completely shot. It was the foundation was about 2 feet below the current grade of the land. As the floor joists deteriorated because they were in contact with the ground, and moisture and insects and such were, you know, causing the innards of the flooring to fall into the ground, the previous occupants just sort of layered new layers of flooring mm-hmm. on top to level out the floor again. So when we restored the foundation or rehabbed the foundation, we determined that there were at least three layers of nice thick plank flooring that were in place.
So then what happened? That you decided, okay, this is, we're going to preserve this. Mm-hmm. Do you think he anticipated that this effort would take place? Does anyone know?
I have heard from folks locally that knew him very well, and also from his younger half sister, who we actually purchased the property from, that he'd be rolling over in his grave, kicking and screaming if he knew we were doing this.
Oh.
Actually, because he had no desire to preserve the building.
I see.
And, that's one of the reasons why he let it go.
So he was an antique collector, but when it came to the house, he wasn't too interested in preserving
right,
it.
Right, yeah, and I'm not sure, you know, why he had the attitude about the house that he had, mm-hmm. since it was his family's residence for so much of his life, But it's fortunate that he never got around to actually tearing it down.
So this summer when we saw suddenly the house raised, what was going on then?
That was actually last summer.
Okay.
We purchased the property in late January. And in May of 2003, we had Virginia House Movers, a company out of Blacksburg, come. It happened to be during National Preservation Week, very timely.
Good.
Move there. Because we had determined that we could not jack up the house from the foundation in order to repair and replace the lower sills, the wooden sills that rested on the stone foundation and rebuild the foundation that way, because of the level of deterioration that the bottom 2 feet of the house was basically shot. We determined with the assistance of this house moving company that we had to actually jack the house up by placing the structural steel underneath the second floor structure. And So there were five steel beams that they inserted into the house from the front to the back, two very long, very large steel beams that they inserted below those two, below those five beams from the side, and using hydraulic jacks, they lifted up the building. I think they lifted it 5 or 6 feet up above its previous grade.
Was that pretty expensive to do?
Oh gosh, it was horrendously expensive, and one of the reasons why we're having to ask as much as we're asking for the property right now. We contracted for that at $40,000 to have that work done. And, you know, had the property been located in a less desirable location, in a less value oriented neighborhood, we probably wouldn't have been able to afford to do it. But we were able to buy the property for a little bit less than its assessed value. And the work that we've done on it to date has not brought it too far up, we don't think, to make it out of reach for a rehab program for someone to take on.
Well, so who is – what kind of person is going to take on the rehab?
Well, that's a good question. We've got a number of parties that are interested in the property right now that we're working with to try to develop plans that respect the integrity of the house, the land in the house, the land the house sits on, the outbuilding on the property, believe it or not, which is a three-part late 19th century sort of shop with some accessory functions attached to it. Also to fit within the character of the historic district, the any exterior changes to the property that are visible from the public streets will have to be approved by the Lexington Architecture Review Board as it sits in the historic district. So
the jacking up and all the things were done, nothing damaging took place, really. I mean, it was a success.
Right. We believe it was a great success. The second floor, we didn't really have to touch anything up there. Mm-hmm. The first story, all of the structural sills around the at the base of the foundation did all require replacement, and we did have to have some new siding milled to match the original beaded weatherboards that were on the house. We restored two of the first floor windows that had been located elsewhere on the property, back onto the facade, and
it's an amazing transformation.
It's been a lot of fun. And
are you thinking it will be a commercial site?
Well, it's zoned to allow for either commercial or residential uses, and we've had folks inquire about it from both perspectives. Mm-hmm. So we're not sure exactly what it's going to end up being, but we do know that it's going to be sold to a preservation sensitive buyer, as all of our previously owned revolving fund properties have been, because we have an easement that will attach to it that will protect the exterior and probably some selected interior features as well.
Another building that I recall was the old surgeon's house on the VMI campus that I think was demolished recently as part of a building plan of VMI. Did I read that the HLF had taken a position that building should be preserved?
Yes, we found out in September, late August or September of last year, that there were plans to demolish two of the older houses on Post, one of which, the Wise House on Letcher Avenue, right at the junction between Washington and Lee and VMI. Was demolished in the fall, and at the same time we found out about the plans to demolish the post surgeon's house.
So, how did you all know about the surgeon's house, about its historical importance, and then did you object to the demolition, or how does that all happen?
We knew some about it, and of course, as we learned that it was threatened, we learned a lot more about it very quickly. And it was built in the 1890s. The architect and contractor was the same fellow who was the contractor for our courthouse and for a number of well-known houses and buildings, both in Lexington and on the two university campuses, William McDowell. Mm-hmm. He was the leading architect, developer, builder in Lexington of the time period. And, of course, it's one of a pair of buildings that were built to flank the infirmary or the hospital up on Institute Hill. And as such was intended to, we think, reflect in some fashion the classical symmetry that Stono, up at the top of that hill, actually has.
Mm-hmm. So worth preserving for
several
reasons.
It's, because it's a state-owned institution, we felt that there was a certain obligation on the part of the Virginia Military Institute and the state of Virginia to look as hard as possible at trying to find alternatives to demolishing the building, rather than just to say it's in the way and just not deal with it.
But that didn't work so well. I mean, the building was leveled.
Right. It did. The end result was that it was leveled. We were able to, I think, assert and assert the right of the city to be informed at an early stage in planning processes for VMI projects. Mm-hmm. They have a legal right to be informed, and as a result, the community has a right to be informed early in the planning stages for major capital projects, especially projects that involve demolitions of historic properties.
So there was some dialogue begun as a result.
Yes. Much of the VMI campus is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and the drill field area and the major buildings around it are also National Historic Landmark, which is the highest of the high in terms of designations, the U.S. Capitol, the Virginia Capitol. Mm-hmm. Just so happens that VMI, as a historic district, also has that very high-ranking designation. And
the current – we only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask you about a current issue, of the courthouse issue in Lexington. What are the concerns of Historic Lexington Foundation with regard to the courthouse project?
Well, we've been working to educate the county and the city as much as possible on their both their rights and their responsibilities as part of the federal review process for historic preservation projects. Because the county is seeking low interest loan financing from USDA's Rural Development Office, they have the obligation to preserve as much as possible historic properties that are affected by their undertaking, mm-hmm. the courthouse project. And unfortunately, because of the time limits imposed upon the design process by concerns about litigation from the Commonwealth and from the circuit court system, and because of concerns for working within that very abbreviated planning schedule, some of the opportunities to involve the public in planning, again, at an early stage in development rather than after the design was already developed, were not taken. And so our position has been that we want the city and county to get their low-interest loan from the USDA. In order to do that, they need to adhere to the historic preservation laws of the federal government. And, you know, we are standing ready to assist them in whichever way possible, mm-hmm. to help them get the low-interest loan and to save taxpayer dollars, but also to preserve the integrity of our historic downtown.
Well, one day I'd like to take a walking tour with you, Leslie Giles, and look at some of the other places in Lexington that I wasn't able to ask you tonight. We're out of time, but I want to thank you for coming into the studio to tell us about the Roberson Phelan House on Jefferson Street and some of these other properties that really are part of what makes Lexington such a rich place to live in. So thanks for coming in. I want to thank my producer, Chris Vredos, tonight, and David Powell, and as always, Jeremy Franklin of WLUR. Remember, next week we'll be on the air Wednesday, the night after the election, with some interesting guests to look at what did and didn't happen. Thanks again for being here. Equal time. Good night.